All right, you curious and curious early birdies. It's officially budget day plus one. And joining me on the pod are all the policy chops you could ever want, crammed into one Zoom room for the next hour. Our own hurly-burly budget lockup. The policy panel is here, making their fourth appearance on the show, Dr. Jennifer Robson, Sean Spear, and Tyler Meredith. I'll just remind you of their bona fides. Jennifer has held senior roles in policy development and research with the federal government. She's now program director and associate professor of political management at Carleton University. Her primary areas of research are the intersection of household finances and the design and implementation of social policy. Sean is a former senior economic advisor to Prime Minister Harper. Today, he's senior fellow at U of T's Monk School of Global Affairs and Public Policy. He's also a founder and editor-at-large at the very excellent thehub.ca. Tyler is the former head of fiscal and economic policy for Prime Minister Trudeau and Ministers of Finance Chrystia Freeland and Bill Morneau. Today, he's a founding partner at Meredith Boson Cool Policy Advisors. So, a little instant post-budget policy analysis on the docket today. Sean, Tyler, Jennifer, really glad you're back on the show today. You know, I don't know where you guys were yesterday, but back in the 90s, I can tell you that I watched budgets in a control room with focus groups in five locations across the country, providing me with real-time feedback on every second of the Minister of Finance's speech and of the responses from the opposition leaders and critics, and that I would be compiling all of that data and hustling to get notes to the minister before he started his round of post-budget speech interviews, especially the one with Mansbridge, because back in the day, everybody would watch the interview in Canada, would watch the interview that the finance minister did with Peter Mansbridge. So we would say, this line is working and that line is not working and this argument needs to be beefed up and people hate it when you say this, all that kind of stuff. So budget days were hugely fun, and they were the culmination of months and months and months of work. So for the people involved, they're enormous. Where were you yesterday, Sean? Were you in the lockup?
No, I was walking my poorly behaved beagle through Central Park for most of the afternoon, waiting for the budget materials to get up online. If I can just take your comments about Mansbridge, though, for a minute, as an entry point, David, we used to talk when I was part of the Harper government. What were the three things Mansbridge was going to say at the top of the telecast about the budget? Because, of course, the budget document contains a raft of measures, but there's only time for him to highlight three. And our communications team in PMO used to lament this because we were essentially vomiting out all of the government's key economic measures and social policy measures in a single document, a document which no longer provides a straight economic and fiscal update. It is, in, for all intents and purposes, a mini speech from the throne. And it seems to me that this year, Prime Minister Trudeau's communications staff won that battle. And it manifested itself, of course, in about a week to 10 days of pre-budget announcements, such that the reason I could spend my afternoon in Central Park yesterday was most of the key signature items in the budget had already been announced.
Unfortunately, Mansbridge isn't what he used to be. And I don't mean that literally. I mean it figuratively. Tyler, were you in the lockup yesterday?
I was not in the lockup. I was also, like Sean, madly trying to read the document at 4 o'clock when it went online. Mm-hmm. And I will just say I shed a little tear for the fact that budget.gc.ca as a domain name seems to no longer be active, and they've moved everything to canada.ca, which, I don't know, I used to love that that domain because it's very easy to find stuff. But all that to be said, I take Sean's point that there are really only two or three things that people can retain in how this budget is framed. And I think what's interesting is while there was obviously a lot of stuff that was pre-announced, there's actually still a lot of stuff, even that's not at the that's not the headline item in terms of particularly the tax change that I think we'll probably talk about a fair bit this hour, that was also announced yesterday. And for me, there's some very interesting things in there on the Canada Disability Benefit, for example, some of the changes that I know Jennifer will probably want to talk about in terms of access to things like financial advice, and even some really interesting economic growth things, which probably is not what you would take away from a budget that raises taxes.
Interesting. Jennifer, tell me, you were in the lockup. Was anybody on this podcast in the lockup?
I was in the lockup. And I got to say, like, you know, I went into the lockup thinking, why do I need to be here? We already all know what's in this budget. when Tonda McCharles from the Toronto Star says, would you come in? Like, you say yes, right? Like, that's, you know, anyway. So I went in with the Tour Star group, and was there, you know, as part of the media from 9 a.m. Didn't take that long, honestly, right, to flip through in terms of what are the key things. Tyler's right. There's other bits and pieces in there that are probably not going to be the attention grabbing headline type items, but are, you know, I think meaningful. What was interesting, though, was that, like, some of that narrative around, oh my God, this is a tax hike budget. There's nothing here on productivity. Like, a lot of that narrative, you know, worst budget since 1982. A lot of that, narrative had kind of already landed. And so, anyway, it was an interesting lockup to be in the sense that people had very much already made up their minds about what was in that document and what it all meant.
David Dodge must have been anticipating a different budget, wasn't he?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in some ways, David Dodge did the government a solid because he went out there and said a whole bunch of nonsense that never turned out to be factual or accurate. And the government, I think, benefited from having expectations misdirected or misset in a certain direction that then means, yes, they will have a fight about a tax increase, but it's a tax increase that's a lot narrower than a lot of people were expecting.
Yeah. So let's go back to this Mansbridge metaphor that we've been working on. For you, I'm not asking you to do politics here. I'm asking you to do policy. What's this budget about? What's the headline? You're writing the headline about this budget. Jennifer, what is it?
The headline about this budget? I'm going to give you the same line that I gave to Susan Delacourt and she ran with it in her column, which is, this is the bucket list budget. This is the last budget that we know is going to pass for sure. So there's a bunch of items that
she said it was their fuck it list budget.
She didn't use that word, but yeah. Do you guys remember the last Obama speech to the White House Correspondents' Dinner? Right. And this is when he got feisty and he was like, screw it. I am done mucking around with like this uncooperative Congress, you know, executive order on this bucket. Of course, applying bucket. But anyway, there's an element of this budget to me that is. So I know the headline is supposed to be intergenerational fairness. And certainly, you know, I saw Paul Kershaw in the lockup and he was nodding very, very happy about some of these issues. But I think actually this is more like, right, this is the last time that we get to say for sure that this budget is going to pass. So let's check some things off of the to-do list. That was kind of the overall message for me.
I agree. I would say at the risk of humbling Tyler, that in a way, I think he represents the kind of intellectual center of gravity of Big L liberal politics these days. And over the past few days in advance of the budget, he was effectively saying, for the first time in a lot of ways, that what we need is a bigger government. I think at different times, the Trudeau government has instinctively believed that, and in some ways has operationalized that underlying assumption, but hasn't spoken in those terms. And I interpret this budget as, in a way, a case in favor of bigger government. And the tax increases, whatever one thinks about them, are designed to close the gap between the growth in government as a share of GDP on one hand and revenues as a share of GDP on the other hand. This amounts to, in a lot of ways, a kind of ideological proposition about the size of government in Canada, the things that we think government ought to be doing, and our collective willingness to pay for that. And I think ultimately that sets up, if you're a policy wonk, a pretty interesting ideological and political contrast over the next 12 or 18 months.
All right, Tyler. Sean told us what he wrote in the Hub this morning. Jennifer told us what she told Delacourt to write in the Star today. You got something new for us?
Well, so I want to pick up on the point, though, that Sean made there, because I think he's on to something in the government's own thinking, in that, and there's a reason they connected the tax and the specific tax that they did on wealth in order to talk about intergenerational fairness. Because if you go back to the early 2000s, a time that you will know well, David, from your time around the party and around government, we cut a whole bunch of taxes and we shrunk the size of government on the premise that that shrinking the size of government and shrinking taxes would actually lead to a whole bunch of extra productivity, right? And would lead to extra growth that would be better distributed across society. Turns out 25 years
would
later...
Would also give Stockwell Day no path to winning an election.
Sure. And yes, and you were right that that worked politically at that moment in time. 24, 25 years later, I think we have determined that that thesis did not really work out the way it was intended to. It meant that the state was maybe more efficient in collecting dollars, but it certainly didn't produce anywhere near the degrees of growth or income that people were expecting, certainly in the distribution at the middle or the lower end that we were all expecting that would do. And so if it's not going to generate that growth, right, and we still have lots of other problems in society, climate change, housing, First Nations, Indigenous issues, how we think about defense and foreign policy, Canada's place in the world, I could go on down the list, then probably the state needs to be bigger in order to address those problems. And I think what this budget is about, yes, it's about fairness because that's the headline they want you to retain, but it's about a reformulation of what fairness is in a world in which we've tried a thesis that didn't work. And now actually we need to repair the state in order to help provide some of those basic public goods.
Jennifer, do you see that kind of robust alternative thesis of government in this budget?
Look, I think that there is a thesis to be advanced for spending side measures to improve productivity. I don't know if anybody else caught the paper that was released by the IMF yesterday looking at, has a really nice graph actually. They've done some really interesting modeling on various types of measures that could actually boost productivity. And there's a couple of key takeaways in there. The first is that, you know, the supposed overhang effect, right, of public debt as a way of depressing or having a reducing function on productivity and growth is actually relatively modest. So that's, I think, one thing, right? Because that's always part of the counter argument, which is that actually we need smaller government to get out of the way. Another piece that comes out loud and clear is opportunities for major growth on AI, and also by encouraging better allocations of labor and capital. And I think actually the government has a thesis that they could advance with many of the elements that they put in the budget yesterday in terms of some of the AI investments. Honestly, even some of the measures with regards to taxation of capital gains, frankly, some other bits and pieces. But when I talk to the folks, like that's not the thesis that is kind of coming together. And I worry a little bit that the focus on sort of intergenerational fairness is maybe getting in the way, honestly, if what they want to advance is that coherent argument or a coherent argument that actually bigger government is required in a more complex, multifaceted and challenging and uncertain world. There is a thesis that they could advance there. I think, you know, Tyler, to Sean's point, Tyler, you've actually done an awful lot of that groundwork for them. Will they pick up the ball and run with it? I don't know.
Jennifer mentioned Obama's press correspondence speech. I'm reminded of the West Wing episode where someone writes on a piece of paper, "Let Bartlett be Bartlett." And it seems to me this budget, which is a culmination, I think, of the government's post-pandemic thinking.
Those are the last scrolls they find when they investigate the ruins of a destroyed political party. They find, somebody wrote, "Let so-and-so be so-and-so."
Well, I'm neither endorsing the premise nor claiming that it's going to have political fecundity, but you do get the sense that something shifted within the Trudeau government in and around the pandemic or post-pandemic period. Part of it was personnel, part of it was changing circumstances, but I think it's increasingly come to grips with a kind of political economy worldview that basically thinks that bigger government is a good idea. And up until now, of course, it's enabled people to have bigger government on the cheap by deficit financing most of its spending growth. And again, whatever one thinks about the tax change yesterday, it's a pretty significant one. It's going to bring in $20 billion in revenue over the next 5 years. What, next year, almost $7 billion, the equivalent of a GST, a single point in the GST hike. This is a kind of meaningful step to bring federal revenues and the government's spending ambitions into something approximating balance. And I think it opens up, as I said earlier, a pretty interesting political debate that we really haven't had for decades, which is, what do we think about the proper size and scope of the government, and how much are we prepared to pay for? I think the conservatives are prepared to take their chances on that battle, but it'll ultimately be up to the liberals to make the case that that bigger government is worth it.
Can I just pick up on that point, David? And I want to say two things to what Sean just mentioned, because I think he's right. So if you go back to the mid-90s, federal revenues as a share of GDP was about 17.5% at its peak, just before the tax cut kind of era started in the early 2000s. That declines to, at its lowest point, about 14% of GDP. So we get effectively a 3.5 percentage point of GDP tax advantage that emerges as a result of the changes that happen in the late 90s, early 2000s, around this consensus that says we need to cut taxes in order to restore kind of growth and productivity and investment in the country. And over time, because of how changes in the economy have happened, because of changes in things like closing of loopholes, changes in tax administration, that 14% rises to about 16 or so percent in the last couple of years. So we carry back about 2 percentage points of that advantage. And that's before we've touched any major statutory change in the tax rate. It's just closing loopholes, changes in the economy, changes in composition of how income occurs in the economy. Now, what's interesting about this particular fight that the government has taken on, it is the first time that they're actually touching a statutory lever that goes at something quite structural in the way we think about taxes. And look, I think this is going to be a very popular tax change on its own, because it's somewhat hard to argue against in the design of what they've done. And it's a very small number of people who actually benefit from it. And I think most people would be a bit maybe shocked is too strong a word, but a bit misinformed to know that that most people, if you're in the top 1%, you ordinarily get about half or more of your income from capital gains. And so if you do, you know, you're taxed at a much lower rate than, say, someone who's a nurse, right? And so this change is going to be quite material to addressing fairness and intergenerational fairness, but it also has an effect of being the first structural tax policy change that this government has really taken on beyond what was done in 2015 with creating the new top tax rate, which was important, but was much more targeted than what this is.
Okay, so let's judge. I want to get to the tax measure, obviously, but first I actually want to, Tyler started to do this, test this budget, assess this budget against its own test, which is fairness for younger Canadians. They say fairness for all, and then they say, but especially for younger Canadians. I love the idea of fairness for all, but especially for some people. And so does it meet that test, Jennifer? Is this a budget that improves fairness outcomes for millennials and Gen Z?
So, look, the weight of that argument is resting very heavily on all of the housing measures, right? As sort of the primary pressing concern of those generations in terms of their ability to afford a place of their own, and especially to afford to buy. There are measures in there that I think have the potential over time to increase housing affordability. Part of the issue is going to be that you know, the housing stock does not just appear overnight, right? This is going to take time, and so it's one of the challenges, I think, of getting into a fairness kind of debate and argument is that there's an expectation of fairly instantaneous results. Yeah. Right. Whereas actually a lot of those housing measures are going to take 5, 10, 15 years, right, to kind of work their way through the system. There's also another risk here, I think, that bears talking about, like, and I'm sorry, I'm tying it back a little bit to our conversation around bigger government, which is This is also about how activist the federal government is going to be vis-a-vis areas of provincial jurisdiction. And so I think another area to keep an eye on as a thematic of this budget is, you know, just as Obama was like, that's it, I'm done pussyfooting around with Congress that doesn't want to play ball with me. I think this is the government that has decided that picking fights with provinces is one avenue that they're not going to be shy about anymore. And the way that this relates back to this question of fairness is that in order for many of these initiatives to work, you mechanically, you have to get enough provinces on side.
So I would just say, I said earlier that the government at different times has been insecure and self-conscious about bringing expression to its ideological commitments to bigger government. In a way, it's sort of done it by stealth as opposed to making the explicit case. And I think that a change is reflected in the budget. On the use of the federal spending power, I don't think the government at any point has had any self-consciousness about that. In that sense, I see this budget more as a continuation of the government's agenda dating back to 2015. It has an expansive view of the use of the federal spending power. There is academic research, David, which shows that it's made much greater use of it, not just than the Harper government, but really of any government over the past several decades. Up until now, the provinces have cried afoul, but ultimately come to the table because they can't resist the dollars. One wonders, given the Trudeau government's political standing, if the provinces will have stiffer spines on some of these issues. I think Jennifer is right. A big outstanding question of this budget is how much ultimately gets implemented, given that so much runs through provincial capitals and city halls across the country.
Who are the innovators, Hurly-Burlyites? The ones who see beyond status quos, the ones who make new and better. I treaded lightly onto this topic last week. In the world of telecom, I have to think our presenting sponsor, TELUS, operates with a more open, more willing, more inventive mindset than most of their competition. Their list of firsts to better connect us is long. I mean, this is the 232nd ad in this series. 232. I've told a lot of those innovation stories. TELUS would like to bring that mindset eastward into Ontario and Quebec as a skin-in-the-game provider of fiber internet. I'll spare you any long-winded explanation of market forces and just say this. Innovation generally means better outcomes for customers, because the competition gets pushed to improve their own products and services in order to keep up. So here's an example of innovative thinking TELUS can bring to more customers east. It's from their subsidiary, Koodo Mobile, and it's called the Happy Stack. Short story, Koodo Internet was deployed in Manitoba, Ontario, and Quebec just last October. The Happy Stack followed quickly. Basically, it's a first-of-its-kind bundle, letting customers stack up their cell phone plan, home internet, and entertainment streaming, Netflix, Disney+, Amazon Prime, at unbeatable value. Savings of up to 23%. The Happy Stack is just one example, but it's predictive of the good that can come when TELUS is allowed to bring new thinking into new territories. Customers want new, better, and more affordable ways to get the stuff that matters to them. What TELUS wants is to bring sustainable wholesale wireline to the east, where the CRTC has deemed the need for competition most urgent, and bring them more of that stuff. Let's talk about the fiscal track. Let's talk about the fiscal track for a second. So, the government says it has stayed within its guardrails and the benchmarks that it set out for itself. People may not think those were incredibly stringent and they barely met them, but nonetheless, they met them. But we are looking now at no longer seeing forecasts for a balanced budget. We're seeing deficits, perhaps smaller ones, depending on what happens to the spending profile, but deficits out as far as the eye can see. Tyler, is there any reason to be concerned about this fiscal track that we're on?
I think we'll have to watch and see what credit rating agencies say in the next couple of days, because it will be interesting to see how they react to the notion of there being a new tax being put in place as a way and how that affects the fiscal framework. Because ordinarily, if you're just marking this on the basis of the fiscal framework, In terms of debt, actually looks a slightly bit better over time than previously forecast in the last budget and in the last fall economic statement, and so that should look good. But I think there may be some pause as to is there going to ever be a time period over which we will get back to balance. And I think this opens up actually a really interesting political question for the opposition, because I don't know that Pierre is going to feel pushed to want to be all that aggressive in trying to reach a target of balancing the budget, in part because the things that he would have to touch potentially to reach that balance actually set up a bit of the political traps that I think the Prime Minister has laid for him in terms of some of the new programs that are here, whether it's childcare, as you've seen in the past, or even some of the spending like the Canada Disability Benefit, the school food program, and so forth. The one thing I will say, David, that I think went completely unnoticed yesterday, which matters to this question of fiscal credibility, and it's interesting to the broader can this government save money question, they are proposing to cut 5,000 positions in the public service by attrition. That is the first time I have seen that direct, specific statement made. I think it maybe speaks to why folks like QP were a little bit negative in their reaction to the budget yesterday. But I just think that's interesting, because at the same time, behind the scenes, Minister Anand has been undertaking this spending review exercise, which up until now has been very painless. Like, that also speaks to the size of government issue, that they've been able to find potentially $15 billion of savings, and no one has really kind of noticed yet those cuts, because there is a lot of stuff that you can potentially target, right? But the 5,000 positions that now they're going to reduce by attrition, it'll be interesting to see where those come from and whether those touch any frontline services that Canadians see.
They could start with the people who are running side gigs contracting to the government. They could attrit all those people. Sean, do you have a different take on the fiscal track? Do you think this is worrisome? Think these deficits matter?
To an extent, I'm more focused though, just on spending growth itself. This year, David, spending is projected to grow by about 7%. And then it sort of falls off the cliff in the subsequent years in the fiscal planning period to something like 3.5%. The likelihood of those numbers remaining at 3% when the government's track record is annual spending growth of something like 6% or higher strikes me as pretty low, which is a long way of saying, unless something extraordinary happens in the economy in the coming years, I think there's reason to think that there's downside, not upside, to the government's medium-term and long-term projections.
All right. Jennifer, you concerned about the fiscal track?
So not overly. The reduction of 5,000 positions in the federal public service through attrition, that's going to be quite straightforward to do, because actually growth in the federal public service has largely been through temporary contracts, 90-day contracts, term positions. All of those have a natural expiry date. The spending review identified, I think, what was it, a little over $10 billion, almost $15 billion in spending reductions. This budget basically.
Can I stop you?
Yeah.
Maybe, I don't know. Tell me what the lockup was. I saw no profiling of that whatsoever. Do they not want us to know that?
It's already been profiled.
Yeah.
No, but I mean, in terms of the way they talked about it, they didn't want to emphasize that message, I don't think. Did they?
Good. I don't know. Yeah. I mean, it just, like, nobody asked. It didn't come up. I only know about that because I am a geek and read the main estimates back in February. An awful lot of the way that those spending reductions were done is essentially by doing a couple of things, like, obviously reducing travel, capping new hiring, and then sunsetting things and not renewing it. And I think this budget largely just sort of took those savings and reapportioned them in some cases, actually, like taking money from the regional economic development agencies, from one grants and contributions program, and putting it back in for a new one that's dedicated to AI instead of what they were doing before. Fine. Okay. We are not back in the 1990s in terms of the fiscal pressures that we were facing then, right? It's a different kind of environment. Medium term, the real problem on the fiscal side is still at the provincial level, right, in terms of pressure and healthcare spending. And there is a difficult conversation still to be had here about what are we going to do on that front and what is the federal share of that. So no, I guess the long story short here is I am not overly concerned with regards to the fiscal track that they've put themselves on. I understand that there is skepticism with regards to their willingness to stick to the fiscal guardrails, but I actually think that largely that's code for I just don't like those fiscal guardrails. I wish that they had my fiscal guardrails instead.
So on the subject of intergenerational fairness, Don Drummond came on this program and argued vociferously in favor of balancing the budget on the exact grounds of intergenerational fairness. He said there is so much shit coming down the pipe at younger Canadians, start with climate, right? That surely we should leave them a clean balance sheet so that they have the resources and room to address those problems without inheriting a 30% debt to GDP ratio. Sean, what do you think about that?
Yeah, there's something to that. Tyler said that it's quite likely moving forward that we'll need to have bigger government rather than smaller government. And, you know, that's not even a normative argument. That's arithmetic. When you think about the growing share of expenditures dedicated to seniors, when you think about the costs associated with climate change, evolving geopolitics, et cetera, and we are going to start that era, David, after yesterday's budget, with government spending as a share of GDP at the same level it was before the Martin government, before the Chrétien government and finance.
I'll take it.
and Paul Martin's fiscal reforms, which is to say, if you believe that we are entering a period of increased pressures on governments in Canada, including the federal government, will be entering that period in a weaker fiscal position as a result of the budgetary choices that this government has made over the past several years.
Tyler?
Yeah, well, look, so it all depends how you want to define intergenerational fairness, right? And so there's a whole bunch of people, and Don, I think, subscribes to this, who kind of look at these accounts, right, over time and trying to see whether or not what we hand off to one generation to another is same or less or greater. And I would just say, when we're talking about fiscal policy, right, and especially given the context of the challenges that that you set up, David, and that Sean set up, we have to think about who is best placed to respond to those challenges. And so the government of Canada's borrowing rate is somewhere around 3.5%, a little bit higher, a little bit lower, depending on the day, but generally about 3.5%. In the private market, it would be, depending on the day, potentially double that, depending on who's borrowing, and maybe even higher, depending on the risk profile. And if we're talking about things like how to solve for climate change, it's probably better that government take on those responsibilities and invest now than having to solve for that problem later on. So in a context where debt to GDP, which is ultimately what we hand off from one generation to the other, itself is actually declining over time, which this budget continues to show, and Canada will have the lowest deficit and the lowest debt in the G7 continuously, I don't see how that's a bad thing from a fairness perspective for future generations. So speaking as a young person myself, I think I would like to see more investment in things like affordable housing and things like climate change that we need to do now, because the problem is so great. The reason that we have affordable housing as a problem that is ravaging young people and stopping people from being able to access either affordable rent or an affordable price for a home is partly because we stopped building for the last 30 years. And yes, obviously there's different reasons for that, but one of them is because the federal government stopped investing in affordable housing about 35 years ago, right? And so if we stop doing these things, if we stop building and stop investing, we will reap what we sow.
Okay.
Speaking as a previously young person, though.
Yeah.
As a one-time young person, though, I just want to pick up on this issue, though, of like it's not just about the overall level of spending today and pushing through debt to a future time frame. It's also about the composition of what that spending is, right? So if you are actually spending today on measures that will meaningfully improve long-term growth, increase productivity, improve affordability, improve skills, blah, 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 all that sort of stuff, then actually, even if there is a forward transfer of a debt that has to be repaid, that generation is actually better off, right, in both of those timeframes. Anyway, just wanted to...
Jennifer, sure how do you assess those things? You know, my first job in Ottawa, was in 1983, and I was a summer student to then Finance Minister Mark Lalonde. And Mark Lalonde's policy advisor, a guy named Andrew Troisch, went on to have a distinguished career in the public service of Canada, said to me, everybody who comes here is going to tell you that their request for funds will ultimately pay for itself. Every single person will tell you that in one way or another, as this thing works its way through, it will save the government money or pay for itself. It has an upfront cost, but you'll make money over time. Now, that is obviously 98% of the time bullshit. How do you tell?
Actually, you know what? I think that there are a number of things where nobody is pretending that this is going to pay for itself. The Canada Disability Benefit is not going to pay for itself, right? Automatic tax filing is not going to pay for itself. Those are still good things to do in terms of...
Is child
of...
care going to pay for itself?
The evidence would suggest yes.
Yes, there is evidence that it does generate increased tax revenues through greater labor market attachment, particularly for women. I guess we'll wait and see if that equation holds true in all of the other provinces the way that it did in Quebec, because Quebec actually started with a lower rate of maternal employment. Anyway, we'll see.
Yeah. Right, but surely I used Quebec as an example with Armin Yelnizian last week, which is... Yeah. Surely to God, if Quebec believed that every childcare space resulted in growth and productivity, there would be nobody waiting for a childcare space in Quebec.
Interesting. Interesting. I mean, I know that they have basically a fixed envelope for the capital spending that they are willing to invest any given year. They are focused more on regional distribution. You're right. Right, a government. So a lot of this comes down to what is the time horizon that governments are willing to wait? Because often when there is payoff, whether it's early learning and childcare or other areas, the return on the investment does not come until after the next election.
Right, right. So I want to talk about data again, and I don't mean the friendly android on Star Trek. I'm a pollster. I know the importance of data. Fact is, absent data, you can't make a meaningful plan or strategy or business model or even a sensible decision. As the legendary American economist and thinker W. Edward Deming famously put it, without data, you're just another person with an opinion. So where am I going with this? I'll tell you. We're emerging from an extraordinarily chaotic period. The COVID pandemic and foreign wars, among other things, showed us the fragility of the supply chains we all took for granted pre-2020. Who'd have ever thought new car showrooms would be empty? Anyway, the federal government is carrying out a serious reevaluation of our supply chains. It has opened a new office responsible for overseeing them. Our sponsor, CN, applauds that. The railway is without question the iron spine of Canada's supply chains. And CN believes any supply chain solutions begin with data transparency. Every week, CN posts data on its operations, right down, for example, to every carload of grain moved. It reveals how much of the railway's capacity was used by shippers, what kind of cargo its trains carried, and how many cars went empty. That's in addition to reams of data the railway provides to federal regulators. Other businesses, though, are less enthusiastic about transparency. They consider data to be trade secrets. That has to change. Any serious effort to repair or protect our supply chains will require widespread data transparency. It's quite literally a matter of national security. Okay, I want to look at this tax measure in a little bit of detail. Because it is big, and it's going to be one of the focuses of debate. I think they want it to be. I'm not sure after yesterday. But
sorry, why are you unsure, David?
I'm unsure because it's smaller than I expected given that they were signaling a tax fight. It's a smaller measure than I had expected. Okay. And in her post-budget interview with Vashi Kapilos, the finance minister seemed to back away from the fight entirely. That they had signaled in the budget speech. She didn't want to have it on the air with Vashi, so I don't know what the plan is. But leaving that aside, Paul Martin changed this. So there was a two-thirds inclusion rate until the year 2000, and Paul Martin brought it down to 50%.
Here, here.
It was 75.
It was 75. Sorry, it was 75. Brought it down to 50%. As part of my least favorite of his budgets, the massive tax cut budget of 2000.
My favorite.
But surely that means that this is a good test case. Like the people are going to argue against this on the basis of its impact on the economy and on productivity and growth. Rich people are not going to say, I shouldn't pay more, because they know that's going to fail as an argument. They're going to say, this will inhibit investment. This will inhibit, this will send a bad signal to business, and this will hurt our productivity, not help it. We should have 20 years of evidence. Do we have 20 years of evidence?
Well, we do, in the sense that productivity really hasn't, I mean, it's continued to slow over time. It's gone up and down, but a lot of that has been in response to things like the commodity cycle that happens in Canada, where Canada really depends on a substantial amount of capital investment that happens in a few industries, particularly those that are resource intensive. So I think it'll be interesting to see what happens in those industries, because Canada, like, let's start from the premise that Canada lacks sources of capital and needs more sources of capital in order to invest in all of the challenges that we just described earlier in this podcast. So does this tax change at the margin change the incentives for people to invest in some of those? Maybe, potentially, but I'd say two things. One is the government went out of its way because it knew that it was going to have this question about what would happen to the risk-taking abilities and the risk-taking incentives that this would change. And they clearly went a step in the direction of wanting to take off the table those concerns. One, by making separate new accelerated capital investments in patents and intangibles, which for the innovation economy is super important. I'm not sure that Toby Lutke, who seems to be opposed to this, has picked up on that piece necessarily. The second is they've also created an entrepreneur incentive. And the entrepreneur incentive, when you put it together with the tax change, means that basically anyone who has a capital gain from a business that they're creating over time, once it's fully phased in, that is less than $6.25 million, they will actually be better off as a result of these changes net-net. I don't think it's going to be very easy for someone arguing against this to say that that we should undo a tax change that effectively treats anyone with a capital gain less than $6 million better and anyone over $6 million worse, that's fundamentally somehow unfair. I think most people will find that fair. And I think to the extent that people are looking at capital gains as a source of how you invest and create the capital to invest in new businesses, for example, that's probably not bad. But I think the effect that it would have, if there is an effect, it will be about whether or not entrepreneurs feel that they are now less welcome in this country. And again, I don't think that actually matches up by any means to the substance, but there is a question of whether that feeling has some effect.
I would agree and partly disagree with what Tyler said. I think there is theoretical and empirical evidence that higher taxes on capital will have some negative effect on investment. The magnitude of which is a subject of debate, and you know, as Tyler says, we'll ultimately see. I agree with you, though, David, that I don't suspect that this will become a political fight for a couple of reasons. One, the government has taken steps to try to minimize the broad-based effect of the measure by first establishing a threshold, and secondly, increasing the lifetime capital gains exemption to over $1 million. And this is kind of a regressive measure for a progressive government to basically shield over $1 million of lifetime capital gains. Just in parentheses, that lifetime capital gains exemption used to be about $750K in and around 2013. The Harper government indexed it, and I lost track of it until yesterday and was surprised to discover that we're now in a world where it's something north of $1 million. I think for those two reasons, the government has,
as long as it's higher than the value of my cottage, that's the perfect.
The government has preempted the argument that this is a broad-based tax hike. And then relatedly, I think in part for that reason, I don't think the conservatives will take the bait that this is sort of sufficiently constrained that, well, it probably will have some negative economic effects. The affected taxpayers aren't the type of people that Pierre Poilievre was talking about in his speech before the Vancouver Board of Trade a handful of weeks ago.
No, but it's an easy tax perhaps to mischaracterize, because I bet you $100 that nobody in this country that doesn't have a capital gain understands how capital gains tax work.
Yeah, for sure. 82% of, you know, of the capital gains, sorry, I'm quoting Michael Smart here, I should give him credit for this. You know, 82% of capital gains are claimed by people who are in the top 10%, 57% by people who are in the top 1%, right? So, this is not a tax measure that many voters will be familiar with, and certainly they are more likely to be in suits than boots, to refer to Poilievre's statement in terms of who he's trying to reach. But I guess there's one part that I wanted to pick up on here, which was with regards to the economic impact of this. And I think that there is something to pick at here in terms of an assumption that all capital is necessarily productive and good. And there is also some evidence that you know, there's some dead capital, basically, right? There's capital that is not actually being productively used and mobilized and allocated in the economy. And for years now, the fact that we've had such a low small business rate combined with, you know, kind of the discrepancy between the top rate for T1, like the personal rate, it's created this incentive for an awful lot of rich people to basically incorporate and then just, you know, strip the capital out of their corporation as a capital gain. And I think, you know, there is something to be said here for saying, something to be said for this tax measure as kind of starting to address some of that perverse incentive and maybe encouraging better allocations of that productive capital as opposed to just having it continue to concentrate in the richest people for their own gain, where they're not necessarily the ones who are starting businesses.
Yeah, didn't I read that it's likely to encourage companies to do fewer share buybacks?
Yes.
Right? Which is an unproductive use of their capital, right?
Yes, because they get a benefit in the share buyback structure around capital gain, depending on when they strike the buyback, because it affects the share price. It raises the share price right over time. Just two interesting points or thoughts that I think are important to this discussion. So one is, interestingly, we're recording this obviously the day after in the morning. I just took a quick look at the markets. The TSX is actually up 0.5 percentage point, and it's actually rising at a rate that's about 2 or 3 times faster than the US index. So clearly investors are not ticked off by this necessarily. But the second is an interesting design choice, David, that I think we should probably underline for listeners. They chose to implement this in a way that doesn't come into effect until the end of June, which means that people have a choice. If they want to sell early and take advantage of the current tax structure that's a bit more advantageous, they can. And they can then make subsequent investment decisions after that point in time, knowing what the new rules of the games are. And that's important because often, as you know, David, from your time, when you make tax changes, it's often effective the date of the budget so that there's no gaming that people can take on. This is actually a very intentional choice that the government has made to want to give people enough time to figure out what is the right thing for them. I think that's actually very smart, particularly because if we think, for example, let's say in the housing sector, where people own increasingly the number of people who own investment properties, which would be subject to this. There's a principal residence exemption that we will all benefit from. But if you own a secondary property, you will be captured potentially by these changes. There's an incentive here to sell. And in the short term, this could actually lead to a fair bit of selling that could actually bring down some going prices for new properties. That's interesting.
That is interesting. Okay. Jennifer, I want to come back to you.
Okay.
Because I want to ask you about some of the social programs in the budget. and I'm a little underwhelmed. That will be my starting assumption. I had expected a budget that was going to have a big play on social investment and a big tax measure, create a big fight. I kind of got neither of those things in the budget. And on key social policy measures, they moved really incrementally and not in a way that seems to me likely to impress stakeholders. So the school food program is quite limited, reached 400,000 people. The disability benefit, I think, has badly disappointed that community in terms of the size of it, the eligibility for it, when it starts, all of those things. Why would you disappoint those kinds of people in a budget with so much spending?
Right. Because they have gone all in on the housing spending. And there's just only so many social dollars, right, in a given budget to spread around. You're right. I think the disability community is going to be enormously disappointed in what has been released with regards to the Canada Disability Benefit. On the other hand, there are some small gems in there that I think are important and potentially transformative. So, I want to say, like, kudos where it's due. One is the automating the Canada Learning Bond. And David, you'll remember that was a Martin government introduction initially and then picked up by the Harper government and carried forward. But there's been a bunch of kids who have been missing out on the money that could actually meaningfully impact their life trajectories, right, in terms of their opportunities. So make that automatic, make it easier for people to capture the money that has been owed to them for years. That's absolutely a good thing and an important thing. Probably will not get enough eyeballs or kudos for that. And it's probably not a big vote getter. I get it, right? But it's important. Likewise, the money to support nonprofit access to free financial advice and services through a grant and contribution, I gather, to Prosper Canada. That's important, right? And again, it's probably not going to get enough kudos, but when people are in financial hardship and they can't walk into the bank. The bank is not set up to help them with their particular debt counseling issues. Those are the community services that actually really matter to people's lives and their ability to handle financial straining circumstances. So there are pieces in there that are meaningful, but I don't know that social policy necessarily has to be done through big national programs all the time.
All right. Tyler, take me up on my thesis. Did they walk up to the plate thinking that they were going to swing hard and then bunt it at the last minute?
So I in the lead up to this budget, I think I may have said that I thought it was going to be a, quote, activist-y budget. And created that term. I still think it's an activist-y budget, but I agree with Jennifer that they've put most of their chips down on housing, and they've done that for political reasons that I think we all understand. But to the point about is a half loaf better than no loaf when people are expecting a full loaf? And which do you make a problem worse for yourself when you don't deliver the full goods that people are expecting? I'll just say on the disability benefit, I understand why people will be not embracing that as perhaps the important, significant step forward that it ought to be. There's a whole other case study that we can do it along at another time about how that whole benefit came about. And I think there's some mistakes, to be honest, about the way it was legislated, in that we shouldn't have legislated it first before we agreed on what it was that we were going to design. And that, I think, has led to the misalignment of expectations in the community. But I will just say, as a person with a disability, I think that there is more that we can do here. And the story of a lot of social progress, be it the Canada Child Benefit and others, is that you start small and you build. You keep investing over time. And what at least the Canada Disability Benefit does is that you can continue to invest in it over time. And let's hope that that is the case. And let's hope that there is a multi-party consensus to do that over time. And I would say if people are looking for more dollars in this space, one place they ought to look for, if we're talking about fairness, is the disability tax credit. It still goes to people who are higher income, who don't frankly need it. And if the goal here is to reduce poverty, we could roll some of that into the base.
If I could just laud one particular social policy change outlined in the budget, my favorite measure was an announcement by the government to extend the payment of the Canada Child Benefit for 6 months in the event that a child passes away. A former classmate of mine at Carleton experienced a tragedy last year when he lost his young son and received a letter from CRA insisting that he repay the CCB benefit. Him and his partner, in the midst of their grief, took it upon themselves to advance the case with the Minister of Finance, with the Minister of National Revenue and others, that this change ought to be made so that other families didn't go through the experience that they just had. And I think it's to their credit and the credit of the memory of their son that the government has made this change. And I don't think anybody had previously put in place out of malice, but it's a sort of inadvertent public policy development consequence that emerges, and I'm glad that it's been fixed and the Trudeau government deserves credit for it.
All right. Let me stick with you, Sean, but I want all three of you to help me with this question. I have a political question to which I want a policy answer, not a political answer. My political question is this. This is going to be characterized as a political budget. This is going to be characterized as an election budget. But the way I look at it from a political standpoint is, what can I tell people they get from this? Right? Can I tell them that they get a house? No. Can I tell them their kid will be fed at school? No. Can I tell them that they'll get a childcare space? No. None of these things are universal. All of these things are time implemented building up. What is something in this budget that will impact on a Canadian positively this year? What's in this budget that's going to make somebody feel better about their circumstance in this year?
I think that my instinctive reaction in is some of the increased funding for graduate students. I noted that some of the university related stakeholder groups allotted the budget, even though there were certain things in there that they were looking for. There were certain things they were looking for that weren't ultimately there. It looks like the extent to which the government did anything on PSE, it was to increase funding for graduate students. And so it seems to me that would be one group of Canadians who the government could plausibly say their material circumstances will change in the short term, for better or for worse. You know, whatever one thinks about the kind of politics of that or even the underlying policy case, that's one group who I think is a winner in yesterday's budget.
Okay, Tyler?
Yeah, I take the point, David, that these aren't universal programs, but I would say to you, though, these are programs, and many of them are touching constituencies that are still relatively large, right? Like a first-time home buyer who is a young person, right, who potentially now can qualify for a 30-year amortization of mortgage. Like, we have had an aversion for more than a decade of wanting to do anything in the housing space that is seen as a demand side measure, because it's like it's touching a third rail, this perceived third rail of public policy, that we'd be doing a bad thing if we actually help people afford afford a down payment or better afford a mortgage. And actually, this is a government that's trying to change that. And yes, it's not applying to all homeowners in Canada. It doesn't affect everyone who's going up for renewal on their mortgages. But if you're a parent and you're seeing your kid trying to get trying to put together the money for a down payment, and they're deciding whether or not they can afford an extra $500 a month, which is what potentially you would save as a result of the moving from a 25 to 30 year amortization, that's pretty significant. Like, I can sell that retail. I think that's actually good policy, actually, despite where we are in the housing market, because of the other investments the government has made on the supply side. The other thing I would say, which, you know, you might be able to speak to, is the NSF fees, the not sufficient fund fees that you would pay in your bank. Obviously, it's a small segment of people who are low income enough that that happens materially for them at a given point in time. But even those of us who earn a decent income will know that there's sometimes a lot of money moving between accounts, and you sometimes end up in a situation where your checking account just falls below a certain limit. And so the fact that there's now going to be limits on how banks apply those things, that's pretty universal. I think the basic question, though, is will anybody notice because the government goes out of its way to take credit for it? That's a different question. And that, I think, is where the government ought to actually invest in a coordinated advertising campaign.
Jennifer, what do you see in here that's of immediate benefit to people?
Oh, they're still mine. I was going to talk about the NSF and the banking changes. So since I can't have that one, let me talk about one that's...
So the big winners in this budget are people who kite checks.
You asked for something concrete, right? Something concrete, something like really nice and crunchy. So there's that. But let me actually say that I think that there is something in this budget that will indirectly result in material benefit for people, which is that I don't think that there is anything in this budget that would cause Tiff Macklem to lay awake tonight or last night or again tonight and say, well, that's it. You know, my opportunity to cut rates has now been blown. So I think, you know, relatively modest, and particularly the nature of the kinds of spending commitments that are in this budget, are not going to get in the way of the, what is it? What was the phrase he used? It's in the realm of possibility that we might see a rate cut coming within the year. And I think that would materially, feel to people like a major improvement in terms of their cost of living.
Let me just drill in on that. And Sean, you can address this too.
Sure.
What you're telling me that this budget, this spending, with the increased spending that Sean talked about and with the deficits we were talking about, this is not going to in any way impact on the Bank of Canada's interest rate decisions.
I think it'll have less of an impact than Iran's air attack on Israel over the weekend and what may follow from that. I think the answer is yes. But if I may, I just want to, you had asked about the intersection between policy and politics, and Tyler rightly talked about the budget as a housing budget. I do think it's an open question whether the totality of these measures, and there's a lot of incremental measures related to housing, changes people's minds about how the government is responding to the housing crisis across the country. I saw a poll this week that the Liberals are in third place when it comes to trust with respect to the housing file. And I think it's unclear to me, even if one agrees with each of the individual measures, if people can kind of see a story in the totality of them. And just before I turn it over to the others, let me just say a key part of that story, a part that would have been almost inconceivable 12 or 18 months ago, is some of the language in the budget around immigration policy. I don't know if there's a policy file in Canada that where we've seen such a significant shift in the kind of center of gravity more than immigration policy than we've had. And I think it's come, fortunately, I think, finally. But the open question, it seems to me, if people are ultimately satisfied with the changes that the government's enacting, if we're going to ultimately protect a pretty powerful comparative advantage for Canada, which is that we've been able to achieve relatively high levels of immigration, or pardon me, relatively high levels of public support for relatively high levels of immigration for a long time. And I think that language in the budget was basically a signal that the government recognizes that, for better or for worse, the growth that it's experienced over the past several years has put that comparative advantage at some risk.
Hey, Tyler.
Yes.
I love defined benefit pension plans. I think there should be more of them in Canada. I've worked with a couple of them. I know that they are scrambling day in and day out to find investments that can possibly keep them fully funded as human beings live longer and longer and their obligations mount. This is not easy for them to live up to their obligations. So what's a worse idea than giving them political direction about where to invest?
Well, the government's not giving them political direction of where to invest. They're just saying it would be nice if we could find the ability to work together to find more projects to invest in Canada, because we're, you know, back to the point that we made earlier about.
But you don't say that enough. For no reason. Isn't that kind of a nice family you got there? Kind of a statement.
Well, no, I mean, it is actually a product, like it is a productivity problem, the extent to which they are investing excessively abroad. Like, don't get me wrong. I agree that we should not be in the business of needing to or directing specific kinds of investment. But if the problem that Canada faces is that we have a lack of business investment and we have a lack of capital, we need more capital. And one of the reasons why capital has not been investing in Canada is because as we've built up these very successful pension funds, they have been, you know, to a certain extent, rightly so, looking for diversification globally. And so that means a natural leakage of tens of billions of dollars that otherwise would have been investing in Canada. And so it's not wrong to ask the question, well, how can we rebalance that flow of capital in a direction that can better connect with Canadian businesses? Now, I would argue, though, it's not just a pension.
Well, wait a second. Unless you're saying they're anti-Canadian, the reason they're not making those investments is because they're not the best investments for them.
Well,
Why would you want any criteria other than the best investment for them?
Sure, but how do you define best investment? I mean, we have funds that also invest in things like crypto, and those things go bust. Like, that doesn't mean that there's no risk in these investments, right? Like, a lot of investment has gone into China, and you can see over time that market is actually fairly stagnant. It's not been a market that's actually produced substantial growth for many of these investors. Now, look, I am not saying that government should be in the business of directing pension investments. I'm not making that recommendation. But I do think it's an important conversation to have. And I would say that what we need to be doing is not just asking this about pension funds. This is a debate that we should be having about all sources of capital in our society. Because arguably, one of the reasons why we're kind of on this conversation about pension funds is also because small businesses and growth businesses in Canada themselves don't have enough access to capital. And part of that is because our traditional financial institutions, whose job it has been to create markets by investing in the growth of companies, haven't actually been doing that, right? And so, yes, we can have a conversation about how we bring capital into Canada and whether pension funds can be investing in more things like infrastructure. That's a worthy conversation to have. And I think the government has approached it in a very collaborative fashion. Appointing someone like Stephen Poloz to lead that conversation should not be seen as something that's confrontational, because I think there'll be a lot for those folks to agree on. But we should be broadening that conversation. We should be asking, well, what are financial institutions doing to invest in small businesses in Canada? Because that's our traditional responsibility. And arguably, small businesses in Canada are underserved right now.
Sean, what's your take?
The only thing I'd say quick is I noted that the section about Canadian pension plans in the budget, I was pleasantly surprised that it sounded collaborative as Tyler says, and not potential legislative changes that were being speculated about before the election, or before the budget, rather. I think the most interesting bullet in that section is, if I kind of turned my head and chose to interpret it in a certain way, it could be opening the door to a possible privatization of some airports, which is now we're starting to talk here, right? Like, the problem isn't that the pensions aren't investing in Canada because they don't like Canada. They're not investing in Canada because they're in search of high return assets to invest in.
Yes.
And if we can, and so it seems to me there could be scope for something of a political consensus for a renewed focus on privatization, not as it was in the 1990s to simply reduce the size and scope of government, but in this particular case, to also free up assets for our pension funds to find high returning assets here within the country.
Okay. Jennifer, you got anything you want to say about this?
I guess two quick things. I think Sean raises a really important point, which is that you need to have the kinds of asset classes, right, that these pension funds can actually invest in. That means, like, you need to have, like, scale, right, that is actually going to be attractive to them. And so the fact that there is now going to be a dialogue about how do we create the conditions where they can find that kind of scale that would be attractive, I think is important. And yeah, I agree. Like, Stephen Poloz is not going to be a scary guy for them to talk to on this. The last thing I just wanted to point out, because I can't believe this hasn't come up yet, given the intersection of policy and politics on this, is that let's not forget, right, like, one of the people who raised this as a key issue was Daniel Smith, with regards to one of her reasons for saying that Alberta needed its own pension plan. So I just wanted to say, I think this is interesting in terms of where this dialogue has in some ways been kicked off from. So.
Right. And it was one of the most effective arguments in favor of the CPP and against the Alberta pension plan that she had that in mind for those pension funds. Right. Because people are nervous about that.
But David, can I just I think we need to be fair about this, which is there was, to Prashant's point, there was a lot of speculation out there that the government was going to do something that it had never signaled that it was actually going to do. It never said that it was going to come in and actually start dictating things. That was in some ways, useful or not, it was a fake debate that certain people were advancing because they wanted it to seem like this was a more egregious intervention than it was. And I just think it's interesting. The other thing we should underline here is that when Minister Freeland back in the fall said that she wanted to do something, the moment she came out and said that, Peter Bethlenfalvy, the Ontario Minister of Finance, came out and said, I agree, we should have more transparency in how we invest in Canada, and I want to use the Ontario Infrastructure Bank to potentially partner with those institutions. If Ontario and Canada can work together on this, to Sean's point, there might be something very interesting to do.
Okay. But the CPP investment fund outperforms the case, right?
Yes, but the case does many different things. And I would just say that, again, if you look under the hood at some of the investments that some of these funds have taken on, I don't think you can just say that there is some rational independent model that yields always the best returns. Some funds do better than others, and that depends how they invest, the risks that they take on, where they invest, as much as what they try to achieve. It's not just where you invest.
All right, I want to end up on the topic du jour among chattering class folks these days, which is productivity. And Jennifer, I saw you put it out on social media and you mentioned it earlier in the pod. You've got an interesting little checklist of public policy areas that contribute to productivity growth or decline. So what do you think of yesterday's budget? Does it do things that can be reasonably expected to goose our productivity standard of living a little bit?
Maybe. Look, I don't think anybody has the silver bullet here, right? Like we've tried the tax cuts route, right? We've tried the shrink government route. So this budget does have, I think, some important investments in terms of AI, which that does seem to have a high potential anyway for boosting productivity. Some of the measures around skills development, right? So Sean has already brought up the granting councils, right, boosting access to funding for graduate students. There's also, of course, the learning bond piece. Some of this is going to be longer term, but that matters. Yeah. Where I think we're still missing out, though, is with regards to labor mobility in this country, right? We still have too many interprovincial barriers with regards to some of that stuff. And I don't know that this budget, it just wasn't on the list, right, of things that this budget necessarily took on.
Right. Sean, do you think that there's some economic thinking in this budget that can make a difference?
In some ways, it seems to me the placement of the economic policy chapter later in the budget is sort of symbolic of the way the government thinks and talks about these issues. It as we've discussed before, I think sees the types of social policy investments that we've been talking about today not merely as social policy, but also as growth enhancing in and of itself. It's kind of made a bet on that type of thinking, and I guess we'll see how it manifests. The AI funding may have some effect on the margins, although we're up against some pretty big players, Google, Apple, Microsoft, and others, and it seems to me $3 billion is sort of or $2 billion rather, is a drop in the bucket. The one disappointing item when it comes to productivity is there's a commitment to try to set a fixed timeline for the review of major projects and the permitting process, moving in the direction of some U.S. jurisdictions that have similarly established timeframes. I don't purport to be an expert, but 5 years strikes me as not reflecting the kind of urgency that we ought to have in an era of the energy transition. So that's one area where it seems to me there's scope for a bit more ambition than was reflected in yesterday's budget.
Right. Tyler, you've been pretty vocal that the productivity problem isn't as bad as it's being portrayed publicly, but nonetheless, I know that you're a growth liberal. So what did you see in there for growth?
Well, and I think it's important to remember, Canada's growth story is actually not as bad as we often make it out to be. Of countries that are our size and population, and that are as rich as we are. There are only two others that happen to have bigger economies with and bigger populations that have a higher per capita GDP, and those are Germany and the US. And, you know, there's something to be said that once you get of a certain size, it becomes harder and harder to become more productive. So I think overall, I'm actually not as worried about our productivity situation as many people are. But that being said, if there were, if I had to come up with a productivity agenda, there's four things that I would be looking for. One, competition. Two, skills. Three, an investment or some effort to address the lack of capital that we've been talking about throughout this podcast in order to help create more new business entrants. And four would be, to Sean's point, some kind of regulatory harmonization. I don't see anything in the budget on competition. They've obviously been very active on that front in the last while, but I didn't see much new on that front. And I think that's a lever we need to keep pushing on, because it is the one thing that governments haven't really tried on productivity in the last two decades, and where Canada is a bit behind, especially in certain industries. Skills. This budget is all about skills. I'm not sure that that's going to get known by people, because I think the tax change is going to overshadow things. But it is a really significant investment in research and development, not just in terms of the post-secondary education, but even, for example, basically making it completely, you can write off any investment that you make in patents and innovation. That's a really attractive incentive. We'll see what happens there. The budget doesn't necessarily address access to capital. That's something that I think we need to keep our eye on. And obviously, fourth, I'm a little bit more bullish than Sean on those, on the regulatory reforms that are proposed. There's been a lot of work in the last year of the working group on regulatory reform that Minister O'Regan has been leading. And I think we should all take solace in the fact that Minister O'Regan is a very different minister than a lot of others in the cabinet.
I want to thank you for your time today, the three of you. Thanks for demystifying this budget for me and for my listeners, and helping to explain it. I want to thank our presenting sponsor, TELUS, and our sponsor, CN Rail. Everybody who watched or listened to this show, we'll be back next week with more of the Hurly Burly and probably a more political lens on this budget. But it was fascinating today to sort of pick apart the key components of what seems to be, by everybody's standard here, a substantial piece of work. Okay. Thanks for your time. Thanks for coming on again. Always appreciate your insights.
Thanks for having us back.
Thanks.